It's a great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Iris Barrent. She is a professor of psychology at Northeastern University, where she directs the Language and Mind Lab and conducts research on a variety of topics, including the development of language in young children and how we reason about the innateness or learnedness of various aspects of human nature. She is also the author of several books, including The Blind Storyteller, How We Reason About Human Nature, which we're going to be talking about today. Iris, welcome to the Nature and Nurture podcast.
Hi, Adam. Nice to meet you and talk to you.
Nice to meet you as well. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. So your work is very interesting to me because it covers such a broad variety of topics. But I'm imagining that your earlier work was more focused on language and this work on human nature is more recent. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
So maybe we could start talking about some of your earlier research on language. And then I'm guessing that probably inspired some of these broader philosophical questions. So perhaps we can weave a story out of it.
Yeah, exactly. So I spent most of my career looking at language, and I was interested in language not so much because, language tends to be such a technical field, and I was not interested in the technicalities per se, but rather I was reading Noam Chomsky's work as a commentary about human nature. And I thought that was a hugely interesting hypothesis, the possibility that we are born knowing stuff, which is, to me, that's the core of his proposal, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea that he suggested is that the reason why every child can acquire a language, whereas a cat cannot, right? So, if you have a child and a cat, both raised in the same household. Mm-hmm. It actually happened in my household as my daughter was born around the same time we had a cat. Obviously, only my daughter acquired the language, even though the experience was the same. And that's the critical point. And his proposal was, there is knowledge that my daughter and I and you are all born with. And it's that knowledge that allows us to acquire language. So this possibility that there is innate knowledge is baffling, and I thought super interesting. Basically, it suggests that we go around experiencing our world through the prism of innate glasses that really, as in Plato's story, cave story, right? We are, we see only certain things. We are shackled with respect to what we know and what we can't know. Which raises a ton of issues, including issues about free will and so forth. So to me, that was the core of his proposal, and it was worth it going into all those super complicated, intricate experiments just in order to ultimately attain this goal. So I was going along my way and doing all those party, and people ask you, so what do you do? And I tell them, I'm interested in human nature. I'm interested in the possibility that we have language because we are born knowing stuff, basically. And when you tell it to people, they just look at you. They just give you the look and they think, this is crazy. I mean, what are you talking about? And what they mean by that is, it's not like they came back to me and said, you didn't control for X, Y, and Z, which would be perfectly, reasonable critique to raise, but rather it's the question that struck them as unreasonable. It did not strike them as reasonable to postulate that knowledge could be innate, right? It almost sounded like an oxymoron to them. Or at least that was the impression I was starting to get from them.
Right. So the common alternative viewpoint is something like, rather than the knowledge being innate, it's like maybe the knowledge acquisition device being innate.
Well, the knowledge acquisition device includes the knowledge for Chomsky, right? So it's not, well, that's exactly is the, so it seems, and the research that I had suggested that we had in the lab suggests that that's really the case, that the possibility that you're born with mechanisms, that is not truly shocking. So the idea that you're born with a memory that only has a certain capacity, so you can't remember, tons of stuff on the fly at a spot, that is not terribly shocking. It's the idea that there is stuff in the mechanism, but the stuff that you know, that are epistemic states, as we call them, that the RNA, that strikes people as completely unreasonable. And that is precisely what Chomsky said. So he didn't merely say, oh, you come, you know, you are born with a language network, a mechanism that allows you to do X, Y, Z and to extract rules and whatever. But rather he said, this mechanism also includes certain propositional knowledge that you have innate. There are certain rules that you are born with. There is actual knowledge content mm-hmm. that you're born. And that's where I think people really kind of lose it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What would be an example of some of those innate forms of knowledge be?
So examples from my work, although it's not necessarily something that Chomsky was very big on, because I worked on phonology, which is mm-hmm. so phonology briefly is the sound structure of language. So the idea is that whether there are certain, say, syllables that are preferred to others. Mm-hmm. So in English, we blog, we don't lbog, L-B-O-G. That's not something mm-hmm. that we do. It turns out that this is also the case in many other languages. So that's, lbog is a really unpopular syllable everywhere.
Does that have to do with our morphology? Like certain sounds are maybe easier for our tongue to manage?
So that's right. And that's exactly is the concern, right? So so one hypothesis is, so there are two questions, right? The first is it really the case? Is it really the case that everybody thinks that blog is great, even if the language has neither? And second, why that's the case if they do? So is it in fact because it's easier to produce certain sound combinations? So that's exactly what I try to look at my research. And mm-hmm. with all kinds of experiments, we found evidence that that may not be the whole story. For example, we found that in newborns, when you look at the brain processes blog more readily than lbog. That is a paper that was published in PNAS. And since newborns literally in the hospital have very limited simulation capacity, motor simulation, right? It is unlikely that this is the whole story. Mm-hmm. In another PNAS paper, we showed that when you zap the motor system using, when you zap the brain, so there is transcranial magnetic stimulation, it's the, basically you, it's a device that allows you to disrupt local focal points in the brain by using magnetic stimulation. Mm-hmm. You can do that to disrupt activity in the motor area that control the lips. And when you do that, you see that people still prefer to the good guys to the bad guys. So they still mm-hmm. prefer blog to blog, even though they can't do very much, or at least they can do less in the way of motor activity. I'm not mm-hmm. pretending to say that we've ruled out all the alternatives and that we know for sure, but I think it's a reasonable possibility. And I think it's interesting that the first hypothesis that people immediately consider is that it must be sensory, or maybe blog is easier to hear, or it might be articulatory, blog is easier to say. The possibility that there are actually rules of language that govern this stuff seems completely far-fetched, even though that ultimately, it looks like this may well be a plausible explanation uh-huh. for the data that we have so far.
Yeah.
So here's that's the, exactly the
devil's advocate question. Although I don't know enough about fetal development to know if it's even a valid question. But the idea is, what if even before birth, infants can be predisposed to certain sounds, let's say, from within the womb, and then become accustomed to hearing different sounds?
So you mean exposed rather than predisposed?
Yeah, yeah.
So they actually hear sounds in the womb, and that actually uh-huh. supports their, yeah, great possible. Hypothesis. Very possible, but I don't think uh-huh. right.
Right, because I think there's one more step to that, because it's like, even if that's true, why were the people outside of the womb who are already adults using those certain sounds?
True. So one question is why it's the case that all languages have those preferences, but mm-hmm. but there is more direct evidence. So I think it's a perfectly great explanation that in fact occurred to us when we wrote the paper. Mm-hmm. The reasons why we don't, so, and there is a ton of evidence that suggests that indeed infants do learn in the womb. So that is completely a plausible hypothesis, except for it looks like the resolution of the sound that can actually transcend the womb is not very good. Mm-hmm. So you can hear things like what kind of meter my language has. So if I say, Permit versus permit, right? Things like that. Where is the stress? Those are things that can easily transfer. But whether I say permit or termit or mermit, right? This kind of specific consonant information does not seem to pass. The reason why we think that is when you test infants that are newborns, they do not differ in their sound perception depending on their mother's native tongue. Mm-hmm. So, for example, it is well known that Japanese adults have problems with la versus ra, whereas English adults do not. And English adults have problems with other sounds, right? Which is something that is acquired through experience. So you would hypothesize that if the fetus acquired this information in womb, they would already mirror the perception of their mothers, namely that Japanese newborn infants would still have problems with la versus ra, which is not the case. So we say that when newborns are born, they're all kind of infants of the world. They can hear all, they can respond equally to all native languages, probably because this particular information doesn't come through. So, so the hypothesis that you raise is perfectly reasonable, right? And that makes a lot of sense. But from what we have so far, it doesn't look like. So I think that the idea of universal grammar of innate knowledge is still viable and standing given the evidence. But again, the issue is not so much, can we show, by God, we know for sure that Chomsky was right, but rather, why does it seem like such a crazy idea to us? And that's where the research really started.
So at what point do these infants lose the ability that to learn any language? How big is the critical window?
Somewhere towards the end of the first year, it gradually closes. So first, you don't lose the ability to acquire a language because children throughout early childhood, there's a lot of plasticity and infants can acquire multiple languages. But if you are just looking at this process of categorizing sounds, it's called phonetic categorization, say telling pa from ba or la from ra, around 9 months, you slowly begin, even around 6 months, that you know, we know that there are already differences that are due to experiences. When you test 9 months old, this is the classical work of Janet Werker, you definitely see them acting very much like their parents in that particular domain.
Does that have to do with some type of pruning in the brain? Like it we become more efficient at processing the sounds we're familiar with, but then at the cost of we don't want to waste energy on other sounds.
So it's probably a combination of experience and maturations that both play a role in that closing of the window, or narrowing of the window rather than closing.
So seeing that these innate differences or innate properties of the acquisition of language relate to human nature, is that something that you realized retrospectively in this line of research, or was that motivating it from the start for you?
A priori, rather, right, exactly. That was the motivating, that was the reason to go into all that, the possibility that through looking at language, we can actually learn something about who we are.
So at what point did you begin to transition away from the more technical research and more towards abstract research about how we actually reason about human nature?
So both of them are very technical lines of research. It's just a different line of research. So both of them, I actually still pursue both. So my lab is called the Language and Mind Lab, and we have one line of research that looks at language and the exactly the same question that we just discussed. But as I've started noticing it, basically in an attempt to defend my sanity, right? Because I just couldn't understand why people were looking at me ugly, right? What was I doing wrong? So the first question was, is it really the case that people think that knowledge cannot be innate? So it was my impression that they think that this is a crazy proposition. Is it really the case? Is it a thing? And if so, why? And that kind of led to this research and to this book that happened actually pretty quickly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So we could disentangle that entire question to see what your opponents are getting at. Because on one hand, mm-hmm. it's like, what do you mean by knowledge? What do you mm-hmm. mean by innate? And then also, what would mm-hmm. the counter position be if knowledge is yeah. not innate? Because you could say something like, you know, DNA contains information and information is a sort of knowledge and the DNA is within our genes. So that's one form of innate knowledge, but people probably don't mean that. They probably mean something much more conscious rather than viewing this as like this sort of biological information storing.
So a couple of things to unpack. The first is when we talk about language in the domain, about knowledge in the domain of language, mm-hmm. most everything we talk about is completely under the hood. You have no mm-hmm. idea that, you know, the first thing I teach in my psychology of language class is there is ton of stuff that you know and you don't know you know it. So basically, message of class one, you're a zombie, right? Because you're following rules that you have no idea that you know. So none of that is conscious. None of the interesting stuff about language and about mm-hmm. linguistic rules is conscious. This has nothing to do with what you learn in school, right? Mm-hmm. All those, what people call grammar in school is complete nonsense. Most of the interesting right. stuff that you know, you're completely unaware of. How do you capture that in genetic terms is completely misunderstood. So in fact, you know, we do not know how knowledge is represented in the brain. We mm-hmm. might know a little bit about where things are, but how knowledge is represented, what is it about those representations that, you know, for example, if you know big dogs, then you know dogs. Mm-hmm. What is it about the structure of the neural code that requires one to entail the other? I don't think we have solved even that problem.
Yeah.
So this notion that, so we don't understand how things are encoded in the brain in any detail. We certainly do not understand how genetic information leads to this information to these neural networks mm-hmm. to unfold. So how you translate the notion of innateness to genes is unclear. Certainly nobody is going to say that there is a gene for, you know, that there is noun information in the gene. Mm-hmm. And everything obviously develops. But so I think it's easy to think about this notion of innateness by analogy to innateness in the body, right? Mm-hmm. We think about the trait of, so we come with certain standards about what we intuitively understand by innateness. We all would agree that having two hands is innate, unless, mm-hmm. you know, you have some awful deformity, the genetic deformity. In humans, having two hands is innate. Mm-hmm. Does it mean that the zygote, the egg and the sperm, the fertilized egg has two hands? No, obviously not. Does it mean that it doesn't develop in utero? Obviously not. So every trait of the body develop and every trait will be affected by what's around it. And so mm-hmm. this distinction between genes and triggering conditions is very, very complex. Mm-hmm. That, however, doesn't mean that they're having two hands is not innate. We still believe that this captures an important insight that we all share. So these objections that people often raise when they talk about innateness, yes, but everything developed, true, but so mm-hmm. do bodily traits. And we all do converge on agreeing that bodily traits develop. Mm-hmm. So I think this is important, therefore, to think about innateness when we do that, to separate between different levels of analysis, as the philosopher Richard Samuels, for instance, discussed very clearly. So when we talk about innateness of knowledge, this is a claim about cognition, mm-hmm. which is different from how information will be implemented, say, at the genetic level. So the claim about innate knowledge is simply, it's natural for people to hold certain propositions, certain knowledge, and we do so even if we don't have the opportunity to learn it from others. And this is something that happens naturally in the course of development. Mm-hmm. This is not to say that if I took my daughter Alma and put her in the closet for 20 years, you'll open the closet and also she'll start talking fully formed sentences, right?
Right.
All innate traits need some triggers for them to develop, and language is no exception. Mm-hmm. But critically, you won't say that Alma learned to have the two traits, to have the two hands from eating food, right? You'd say that the food was the triggering information that enabled the unfolding of this innate trait. And we think similarly about knowledge. So the critical claim is that it is not learned rather than, and it happens naturally in humans, rather than it doesn't depend on any environmental input. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between learning something and triggering something.
Right. This seems related to the topic of intuitive dualism that you mentioned in one of the papers that you sent me. So it seems like we have this intuitive belief that for anything physical, like the having two hands, that's a human. That's something that we can clearly point to as innate to humans. But then once we get into the cognitive domain, it's like we start to have this dualist notion of it can't be innate if it's in the mind, because the mind comes later on.
Yeah, precisely. Exactly. So we apply double standards when it comes to what we consider the body, like two hands, and what we consider the mind, like sentence structure, even though it is evident for us as scientists that knowledge of sentence structure is in the body. It's in the brain, just like having two hands. Mm-hmm. And yet we treat it differently.
Uh-huh. So why is that?
Why are we dualists?
Yeah. Where does the intuitive dualism come from?
We don't know. We don't know for sure. There are two hypotheses, right? One is, this is something that we acquire through our culture. This is something that comes from religion. But yet, when you look at many cultures around the world, there is evidence that people distinguish between body and mind. For example, afterlife beliefs are extremely common across cultures. Belief in some kind of, divine creatures, extremely common across cultures. They don't necessarily look the same, but this belief that a being can continue to exist upon the demise of its body is very, very common. And that is exactly dualism. So then the question is, as if it's dualism were kind of natural for people to entertain, why that would be the case. Mm-hmm. And one possibility, which was suggested by Paul Bloom many years ago in his beautiful book, Descartes' Baby, is that the reason why we are all Descartes' babies, so to speak, is because we are equipped with two systems of innate knowledge that guide our understanding of objects on the one hand and people and what make them tick on the other. So there is in fact a large body of research that shows that infants have innate intuitive physics. When you look at newborns and indeed other animals, they come with specific expectations about objects, what objects are and how they behave, that for example, objects are cohesive. And they know that an object can't start moving spontaneously. It must be contacted by another object. Mm-hmm. But when infants look at people, they know that infants, that people can move on their own accord. So when you think about why I moved my hand right now, you think, well, maybe she wanted to grab this bottle or something like that. So she had a mental state, a desire that made the hand to move, even though there are no physical contact that you can see that made my hand move. And therefore that might make you conclude that that desire is not physical, that is something ethereal that's outside the body because it can disobey the laws of intuitive physics. Uh-huh. So in other words, the hypothesis is that dualism emerges from the conflict between these two systems of core knowledge, objects on the other hand, and how we think about the minds of others or theory of mind is the second. Right.
That is very interesting because that seems to suggest that this divergence is present from the very start. But I was wondering if young children seem to personify everything, or maybe we personify everything for them. So if you think of a children's story like Goodnight Moon or the Disney movie Cars, everything, mm-hmm. these non-animate objects have a face and they're animated. Right. Right. And I was wondering if that might be because it's, if children maybe have a single system for processing people and things, and then only later does it diverge.
No, so they definitely from the beginning, they, so it's the other way around. They think about their original intuitions about objects is that objects will only move by contact. And in fact, these experiments have been done with newborns. When they see an object that starts moving by itself without contact, or so you say you have one object that's stationary, comes another object, bumps it, and then the stationary object kind of sits there, wait for a second, and only then starts moving. Mm-hmm. Infants look at that longer compared to appropriate control that move naturally. Mm-hmm. So it does look, and it's not only infants, you see the same in other animals, which suggests that it's kind of something a very old evolutionary trait. So originally you do expect objects to behave as be non-agentive and not to have goals and to move on their own. But you can also have theory of mind, which you can over-project and overshoot that to the object, and that's where you get those.
So is that a natural over-projection error that the children make, or are we just confusing them by personifying everything?
No, this is, so we know that typical children do that. The children with autism are less likely to do that. We know specifically what brain circuits control this. So no, I think this is actually pretty well understood.
That makes sense. Okay, so then there would be some evolutionary evidence for why this intuitive dualism could emerge from a very young age. And then the other...
I don't know that it's evolutionary, but we have a developmental story about how that emerges. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, that's solid. And then I guess the other component to this that's somewhat related would be essentialism.
Right, right. So let's start. So if we run the story of how the big drama, how the collision between essentialism and dualism arise. So let's start with essentialism. So essentialism is the belief that especially living things are what they are because they are. They have some essence that they are born with, that they got from their parents, and that is something that's immutable, that is actually part of their bodies. Mm-hmm. For example, infants believe that if you take a cow and make it have the little cow be raised by, say, a donkey, the cow would still moo and behave like its biological parents rather than like its adoptive parents. At least when they're, around 5 or 6 year old, they would do that. And they would do that even if their culture tells them that innate traits are actually acquired. So even in those cultures, children do tell you that innate traits do not move to the adoptee. So this is essentialism. Mm-hmm. Essentialism then guides our understanding of innateness. We think that those traits that are innate, mooing in the cow, is something that the cow has acquired from its mother innately. And as I said, critically, they believe that innate trait resides in the cow's body. So they say, for example, it's in the inside of the cow. Even very young infants believe that agents must have some inside that makes them tick. So if you grant that assumption, for which I have additional evidence to support, so if you assume that you are what you are because of some essence that's in your body, and you are also dualist. So it follows that if you ask what is innate, it's only what's in the body that can be innate. But dualism tells you, but listen, there is knowledge, all this other stuff that's in the mind rather than in the body. Mm-hmm. So it follows that other stuff cannot be innate because it can't be part of your essence.
Right. I was surprised to find out from my friend, I have a friend at McMaster University, Hassan Siddiqui. He's doing research on essentialism in children. And even these seemingly very superficial traits children tend to believe are essentialist. So, for example, national identity, being American or being Canadian, children apply some sort of essentialist view to it. And only later, at later ages, do you find that people start to reason of like, oh, it's just a function of where you're living or where you were born, and it's not necessarily innate.
So there's a question there. The reason why I talked about biological kinds specifically is that my reading of the research does not allow me to figure out whether this is a property of children or a property of the research. What I mean by that is people use the term essentialism very, very broadly, basically as a way of defining any type of category, whether it's animate or inanimate. It is true that people believe that, especially young children believe that children will also have innately some of the acquired beliefs of their parents. So, for example, they will know that it's, you know, you don't need to stop for the red light and so forth, as religion would be. And it's not clear, and one possibility is that this simply happens because the child categorizes the offspring along with their parents, and because they're a member of the same category, they're attributed to the same beliefs. Do we want to call it essentialism or not? That's a separate question. And what are the criteria that would allow one to distinguish categorization from essentialism? In the literature, those terms are used interchangeably. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's, you know, why do you need to talk about essentialism if it's exactly the same as category membership? Given the research from other labs and mine, I think there is reason to believe that when people think about biological kinds, they explicitly assume that the essence needs to be in their body, which for this reason, I believe that this belief applies there. Whether they would say the same about nationality is an empirical question. I think it's a really interesting topic to explore.
Do you think it would be right to define essentialism as categorization, but where the categories are immutable? So an example of a very changeable category might be something like you identify as a member or fan of a particular sports team, but in theory you could change any day. But then if it's something maybe like race or like sex, those might be difficult or impossible to change?
So that's a great question. I think it's an empirical question that we don't know yet, whether essentialism is simply categorization plus immutability, or whether there is something special about biological kinds that differ in how they are treated. And I just don't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll let you continue on the direction you're going with it.
But regardless of why people make this assumption that things are innate, it is clear that they explicitly require that what innate is in the body. In fact, we have done experiments that show that people link innateness to embodiment, so traits that they can identify in the body they think are innate, and when they're told that something is innate, they think it must be therefore in the body. We know that this connection is true, we just don't know how general it is.
What about things like personality differences, which are in some sense innate or heritable, or IQ could be another example, something that's highly heritable, that seems to be innate, but it's also not necessarily a physical trait?
So are you talking about real science or intuitive beliefs?
How about both? Because I guess I'm proposing on the real science end, this is something that is innate and highly heritable. And then, and folk beliefs, I'm not sure what people believe about it.
So I would, it's a great question and I don't know. So here is, you know, I think you're showing how all these open questions that one can look at and run with, depending on that. My prediction would be, going back to the container versus content metaphor that we discussed earlier, if people think about intelligence as some kind of a container or a muscle, so intelligence is the ability to think really, really, really hard, kind of to, you know, squeeze your brain, so to speak. If they think about it in those terms, that they shouldn't have problems to think about IQ as something that's being innate. However, you know, if they thought about it as more like there is stuff that you know, which actually probably wouldn't, you know, I don't know how that would work anyway. If that were the metaphor, then it would be much harder to accept. So in other words, because we tend to think about IQ more as a capacity to do something rather than as some stuff that you know, I would not be surprised if people accepted that IQ is innate. Right. And I think actually people do, I think there is some evidence that they do just that.
That content versus container distinction is very helpful. Because I guess similarly for personality, you could say something like, maybe personality is a container for, it'll predispose you towards various types of behaviors, but the behaviors or the thoughts themselves are less innate.
Yeah. Or thinking about emotions, right? So if you think about emotions as computations, as evolutionary psychologists would do, then it's like any type of knowledge. And people would think that the idea that this is innate is crazy. But if you think about emotions as, oh, it's in my stomach, right? When I'm nervous, it's in my stomach. Or when I'm happy, it's all in my face. Then people would assume it's innate. And in fact, we looked at that. And we asked people to predict what do they think is innate. We asked them more specifically, what do you think that the hunter-gatherer, what kind of emotions they would recognize? And the more embodied people rated the emotion, the more likely they were to think that that emotion is innate. And furthermore, when provided evidence that that emotion is in the body, for example, here we can show it in the brain, it's right here, then they jump to the conclusion that therefore it's more likely to be innate.
Right. Okay. So then on the essentialism part, we have this finding that people tend to believe that innate things are embodied or embodied things are innate. And then we also know that people have this intuitive sense of mind-body dualism. So then you put those two together, and then it seems to suggest that people believe that things that are embodied are innate and that things that are not cannot be innate.
Exactly. That there are some, there is some psychological, there is a psychological universe that is beyond the body, and everything that in that universe cannot be innate.
And the claim is that this is an assumption that many people and even psychologists are making when conducting their research.
I have to be careful with my colleagues, as in as much as psychologists are people and people, you know, have these intuitive beliefs, then psychologists are at risk. Wang and Fagenson. So as my first paper on the topic was published, Wang and Fagenson published a similar paper on the same topic. It's interesting. Both papers came out together. Part of what they did is actually ask what they called mind scientists, that included psychologists and people who study the mind, to predict what traits of infants are actually innate. And people really undershot. They really thought that stuff that is clearly known to be present in newborns, they thought that it emerges like 2 or 3 years, things like that. So those, we don't know why people say that. So you have to be careful. I certainly don't want to say that, you know, if you're a scientist and you disagree with my view of language, then therefore you're, you know, I'm accusing you of all kinds of stuff. People have very good reasons to believe what they do. I'm saying, though, that if you are not careful, then, you know, this the flute of dualism and essentialism can sing all kind of crazy tunes in your ears.
Right. It does seem in some sense safer or maybe more optimistic to bias yourselves towards thinking that certain things are learned, especially if it has to do with individual differences where there's a better and worse component, whether that might be something like intelligence or health or life outcomes, all of these things. It seems like the more environmentally dependent it is, the more we can do something about it and fix it.
True.
And then if it's like this innate biological difference, there's sort of this helplessness component that's a bit discouraging.
True. And furthermore, so, you know, 20 years ago, exactly, Steve Pinker wrote the book, The Blank Slate, which is still a wonderful book, in which he stated that part of the reason for our blank slate approach is precisely our concern with the moral and social implications of innateness. And there is a very long and painful history of discrimination that arises from essentialism. So essentialism is a really, you know, has a terrible track record in producing prejudice. And if you believe that people are different from each other innately, then maybe some people could see it as license for discrimination, which they absolutely should not, right? So make it very clear, the fact that, I might have a gene for breast cancer doesn't mean I can't get health insurance. So the fact that, you know, if I'm genetically disposed to be different to you, that does not license discrimination against me. But certainly, as you point out, that could be one of the explanations for why people resist, why people are empiricists, why they resist the notion of innate knowledge. I want to make it clear that those explanations are not mutually exclusive, right? So Pinker may very well be right, and people might be concerned about the social implications of innateness. However, I just don't think it's sufficient to explain what's going on in and of itself, because of all the various traits that can be innate, having an innate notion of object, I mean, who cares, right? As far as social implication, that's the, you could say that, you know, the social concerns could be if aggression is innate and so forth, but having a notion of object is the least offensive, right?
Yeah, it does seem to be for those more behavioral questions. I mean, that relates quite strongly to my own interest in moral psychology research. Like if there are certain environmental or genetic markers that predispose people to risk-taking or to aggression, to what extent should we punish them the same amount if it's outside of their control to behave in certain ways that are more immoral? And that also seems to be very tied to the idea of free will, which I really was looking forward to talking to with you about. And I know you talk a bit about free will, or maybe even a doubt a bit of to what extent we have free will towards the end of your book, The Blind Storyteller.
I don't know whether or not we have, so I'm talking about two distinct questions. One is whether in fact we have free will, which I am not taking a position on that. And the second is, are we good at estimating which of our actions are free and which ones are not, which we're clearly not. I mean, people clearly are fooled all the time in their attribution of what's coming from inside and what's coming from outside, what they will and what they want. They keep attributing to themselves things that they, so you know how you believe that, you know, if you wish really hard for your favorite soccer team to win, then you kind of help them, right? This is completely insane. So yes, people, our attribution of free will, and this is work that goes to the late Daniel Wegener, is clearly false. In other work, what's interesting about it to me from the point of view of dualism and existentialism is how those interact. So the way they interact is that in reasoning about free will, people consider it typically as something that is not controlled by the body. So if in order for an act to be freely willed, you assume that you intended the act, and if people are given evidence that actually it's their brain that intended the act, then it's kind of, you know, they don't feel like it kind of releases them from responsibility, including legal responsibility, which is crazy, but it's true. The way this is interesting, though, is because there is another literature that asks, what makes me who I am really deep down? Who is my true self? And here the answer is the true self is good. It's, you know, what makes me act morally, do moral, good moral decisions. And furthermore, the belief is that that true self is part of my essence. And here is where those things collide, because if you really believe that the essence is in the body and that your true self therefore is part of your body, but you believe that what you will freely must be outside your body, how do you negotiate between the two things? Who is your true self, right? Is it, you know, is it moral and therefore outside your body, or is it truly you and therefore your essence in the body? Right. So we ran a few experiments to try to look at that. And the answer that we get is that, in fact, people have different notions of their self one that they associate with the body and one that they associated with morality. And it's a whole mess.
Do you mean, when you say people have different notions of selves, do you mean different people have different notions, or do you mean within an individual in different contexts, they will apply these different definitions?
Great question, which I did not look at that. So all we know is that within the experiment across our population, people responded differently depending on whether you asked them, did the person do that act freely, or who is this person really is, or what is their essence? They gave you conflicting responses. Mm-hmm. Given how consistent it is, it must be probably the same person, but this is not something that I actually track formally.
Yeah. I have an idea that our conceptions of freedom or free will seem to be entirely dependent on how we define our identity. Like here's one example. Let's say you're walking and you trip over your shoelace and you fall, and you ask, was the fall a result of your free will? You could say yes or no. You could say, I was the one who took the failed step that caused me to trip over my own shoelace, so this was my fault. You could also say something like, no, my body ends at my toes, and the shoes are not part of my body, and the shoelace is this outside influence that interfered with my free will and caused me to fall, even though I didn't intend to. So depending on whether you're including or excluding the shoe as part of your definition of self, you could get entirely different answers.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So maybe we could talk more about some of the broader ideas in your book, The Blind Storyteller, and how it relates to some of the research you've conducted over the years.
What in particular? What do I see the implications of the book?
Sure, we could go for implications.
Well, the one that is most striking to me is the possibility, as indicated in the book's name, that we are blind to who we are, just as Plato argued. So let me explain what I mean by that. The results that we have right now are limited, right? We know that when you look at US participants, they are biased by dualism, they're biased by essentialism, and you can show how those two forces combine to bias how we understand who we are. The real crazy possibility is that what makes us blind to who we are is actually innate. So we are blind by design.
Yeah.
If dualism and essentialism were innate, then the possibility arises that humans are such that we can't really look at ourselves properly in the mirror, so to speak. We don't know whether that's true. We don't know whether dualism is innate. We are not sure whether essentialism is innate. We certainly don't know whether the collision between them is innate. All of this is completely unknown.
Yeah.
There are reasons, though, to think that this may not be a completely far-fetched possibility, right? As I pointed out, I think there is good reason to suspect that dualism might be kind of in our cards, although, again, it has not been demonstrated. I think it's a possibility. Essentialism is not innate in the sense that we have evidence for that in 1 or 2 year olds, and not even in 3 year olds, right? There is, so in fact, younger children go by categorization rather than by essence. But nonetheless, when you look at older children, it looks like this is the kind, if by innateness you mean, this is the kind of structure that emerges in people naturally and without the opportunity to learn, then yes, by that criterion, essentialism is innate. So I think that is the possibility that we are blind by design remains out there. And for me, this is the most striking implication.
Right. So I guess we could talk about now to what extent the blindness is adaptive or maladaptive. So it seems like from a purely scientific standpoint, if we have false conceptions about our own human nature, then that's going to lead us to get things wrong when when reasoning about our own psychology. But then in term, we didn't necessarily evolve to be scientists. In fact, we did not evolve to be scientists. So I'm wondering if there are areas in which having false beliefs, these types of false beliefs, might have helped us. So a common evolutionary argument I've heard along this line of thinking is that we may have evolved to be more neurotic than necessary, or than so, like, for example, if you're walking out in the jungle and you see a bush move, and maybe there's a snake there, maybe not, and it seems like there's gonna be like an evolutionary incentive for us to be wary of the bush and avoid it just in case there's a snake, even if we didn't actually see anything. So that would be an example of, I guess, a false belief that might be adaptive in the long run.
True. And there are many of those. I am not going to make this argument for being empiricist. I don't think that empiricism is selected for. I see no evolutionary reason for people, for there is any, it's simply an unfortunate series of events, right? You have dualism there, and dualism itself, as we said, arises from the confluence of intuitive physics and theory of mind. Mm-hmm. We have essentialism. Essentialism might be adaptive. It might be adaptive to understand that living kinds are what they are, and despite their bodily changes in development, they still remain the same. Mm-hmm. That might be an adaptive mechanism. But claiming that the confluence of dualism and essentialism is selected for, first, you don't need to. This happens, you can explain it spontaneously. And second, I don't think it makes any sense. So I'm not going to make any evolutionary claim to support my model.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I guess as long as you can understand each individual component that leads to this phenomena as having their explanations, then it could be like a spandrel.
Yeah. Something like that. Completely an accident. Mm-hmm. We are, our empiricism is an unfortunate accident that comes from the design that we have that serves us well for other areas.
Okay. So what would the call to action be here then? Is it just more critical thinking?
I don't know yet. So we are not there. The whole thing is pretty new. The book is, came out recently. I think one area in which I would like to examine in my lab is what can be done effectively to change it, perhaps to explain why there are many very specific implications of this theory that messes up with our understanding way beyond this, philosophical question of who we are. So the same collision between dualism and essentialism explains why people are biased about psychiatric disorders. Why people get it wrong, why people fall insane about the brain, as we call it, why people think that, attribute to brain and neuroscience significance that is way beyond what these explanations can actually provide, and why sometimes they even think that circular neuroscience explanations are great. There is literature that shows that. Mm-hmm. I believe that this theory can explain that. It can explain why we think that if you have dyslexia, then it must be like all about letter confusions rather than what it actually is, which is mapping letters to sounds. Mm-hmm. This came recently in the New York Times on the weekend, I guess, about how it's difficult for research to accept what dyslexia really is. All those things, so this collision between dualism and essentialism has real bad consequences that affect many areas of our social understanding and scientific understanding. Mm-hmm.
I think we covered just about all the questions I had for you. Iris, is there anything else you wanted to talk about, or potentially other future work that you wanted to mention?
So one future direction that we are looking at is to understand whether dualism is in fact likely to be natural, and whether in fact it is likely naturally to lead to empiricism. This is something that is now under review and we are looking at. I think that this is just there are so many new areas of research that are ongoing in the lab, and you know, but that is all for now. It was so much fun talking to you about all that. Such great questions.
Yes, it was a great conversation. I hope we get to follow up someday and talk about some of the ongoing and future research that's going to come out of your lab.
Yeah, certainly. I'd love that.
All right. Thank you again, Iris.
Thank you.